Fasten your seatbelt, turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Find me in my field of grass. Beneath the sun,
over the next few weeks, Mother Nature's sons and daughters will be out in the woods and on the shores of our lakes, measuring and trying to preserve the quality of the water and the ecosystems that depend on it, and tracking the changing migratory and breeding behavior of our native birds. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, it's a salute to citizen scientists, young and old, who are playing an increasingly important role in our understanding and protection of the environment. In our studio, Eric Olson, director of UW Extension's Lakes Program, Paul Skowinski, Citizens Lake Monitoring Network educator with UW Extension, and Dan Belter, he's the Marathon County Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator. We're marking a number of events this month, the 30th anniversary of the Citizens Lake Monitoring Network of the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership, and the 20th anniversary of the Water Action Volunteers. The Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention takes place in Stevens Point, March 30th through April 2nd. And that same weekend, the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology is holding a community training event in Rothschild for volunteers who want to work on the Breeding Bird Atlas. A little later in the program, we'll be hearing about other citizen science initiatives at the North Lakeland Discovery Center in Manitouish Waters and at the Stevens Point Area School District's Boston School Forest. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. Are you a citizen scientist? Do you think that we need more of an emphasis on science and the natural world and understanding it in our lives today? 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page and I will read it live on the air. Got a jam-packed show today, gentlemen. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Glenn.
Eric Olson, tell us about this year's Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention. It's coming right up.
Sure. It's coming up on starts on Wednesday, March 30th. It's going to be in Stevens Point at the Stevens Point Holiday Inn Convention Center. And this is our annual gathering of citizens and resource managers and decision makers who are interested in the health of our lakes. So they get together once a year in the springtime to sort of share the latest research, to network with each other, to maybe set out some projects that are going to be happening this summer, and mostly just to collaborate, to take care in partnership for our legacy of Wisconsin lakes.
And it is called a partnership, and you've got three legs of a three-legged stool. You've got the Department of Natural Resources, you've got University of Wisconsin Extension, which you're a part of, and also the nonprofit Wisconsin Lakes Organization. Tell us how all of that kind of fits together.
Sure. So the three parts, as you just mentioned, really represent, I think, the government responsibility for natural resource management. With the Department of Natural Resources, they have a constitutional obligation to care for our lakes and rivers. They provide a legal framework, and they also provide funding for much of what happens within the partnership. UW Extension has a 100-year-plus tradition of taking the knowledge base of the state of Wisconsin and bringing it out to the people of the state. So we're sort of both the outreach and education arm, helping people to understand issues and working on sort of training as well as research projects. And then Wisconsin Lakes is really a nonprofit organization that's statewide, but they represent over 600 lake associations, over 200 lake districts all around the state, which are really the place where citizens get involved. And citizens are typically, in the case of the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership, the citizens are mostly property owners. They're people who own a cabin or a lakeshore home, and they have this direct personal interest in the health and well-being of that lake. And so the partnership provides really a vehicle for citizens to step up, to be a part of taking care of these lakes, to contribute to the solution. And I would add that if the Department of Natural Resources provides some of the funding needed, these citizens, through their lake associations and also just through their own personal checkbooks, they provide the balance of that funding.
Now, this convention that you have every year usually involves a number of seminars and speakers. Just give me two or three of the highlights.
Sure. It's a really diverse agenda. We have on both Wednesday all day, in the morning and in the afternoon, we have workshops, and those are typically focused on very specific things. So, for example, some lake associations want to learn how to build and maintain a web page. We'll provide them with a workshop to walk them through that process. Some people want to know about it. There's a new DNR initiative called the Healthy Lakes Initiative. And so people want to know, how do we tap into healthy lakes and obtain grants? So that will be a focus of a workshop. And then Thursday and Friday is really dominated by what we call concurrent sessions. And these are basically short educational sessions that cover a whole range of topics from, again, citizen science, which we're talking about today, to methods and techniques of lake planning and management, to broad sort of ecology questions of Wisconsin's natural world, and examples of really community-driven resource management. We try to highlight success stories of what lake associations and their neighbors have been able to pull off in terms of taking care of lakes.
And it's the people who live on these lakes that are really taking the lead in protecting them. Now, is this open to the general public? What do you have to do to register?
It is open to the general public, and you register online. You can find a link. Probably the easiest way to find it is to go to a webpage, wisconsinlakes.org, and then you'll see a menu pick right there that says the related to the convention. So wisconsinlakes.org, or if you Googled, you know, the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention, it should pop up pretty high on the list. We do require people to register, in part because typically you're going to get meals and snacks included with participating in the conference. So the registration expense helps cover the actual technical expenses of running this event. But you can register for as much or as little of the convention as you want to. We set it up so that if you just see one of these workshops that you want to sign up for, you can just sign up for that one workshop, and that's all you'll be participating in. Or you can sign up for, you know, Thursday and Friday. And most people who do come do sign up for more than just a workshop. They sign up for Thursday and Friday. And this year, sort of a special twist that we're doing is combining our efforts with the Water Action Volunteers, which is the stream monitoring program in Wisconsin.
So you've got the people who are monitoring lakes, and then you've got another group that's also monitoring rivers and streams.
Yep, and sometimes that's a pretty different audience. Sometimes they overlap, but it can be a very different group of people who are stakeholders in our rivers and streams. A lot of them could be, for example, trout anglers, and they just have this strong passion for water quality on trout streams. They're meeting together with the what's called the Wisconsin Citizen-Based Monitoring Network, which is a DNR effort to try to bring all sorts of different citizen science programs together. And the meat of that gathering is actually on Friday and Saturday. So that'll be April 1st and 2nd. And again, people, if that's what interests them, they can sign up for April 1st and 2nd. And it's a very affordable registration fee that does, again, include meals.
All right. So, again, that's March 30th through April 2nd. And the Holiday Inn, is that where
it's? Yep. The Holiday Inn Convention Center, just on the east side of Stevens Point on Highway 10. Pretty easy to find, lots of parking. So it is definitely open to the public. And I would say this is, if you look around the region to other states, our conference is the one that's really meant to be inviting to citizens and just stakeholders, people who want to learn more about this. It's not just a scientific conference. It's not just a bunch of DNR managers. It's everybody being brought together in one common space.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Paul Skowinski, how has the Citizens Lake Monitoring Network grown over the past 30 years?
Sure. So in 1986, it got started with just over 100 volunteers monitoring about the same number of lakes, just doing water clarity measurements. And today we have over 1,000 volunteers, almost all of those monitoring water clarity, but about 500 monitoring water chemistry. We have citizens monitoring native aquatic plant communities, aquatic invasive species communities, lake levels, ice cover on their lakes, temperature modeling in lakes. They have all kinds of different projects that they're involved in.
Why do citizens have to monitor lakes? Isn't this a job for professional scientists, people who actually know what they're doing?
Sure. And there are plenty of professional scientists that do monitor lakes, but the involvement of the citizens as part of this network greatly increases the number of lakes that can be monitored and the frequency that they can be monitored.
Now, as Eric was saying, it's the 30th anniversary of the Citizens Lake Monitoring Network. It's also the 20th year of the Water Action Volunteers, which does the water quality work for rivers and streams. What are the different challenges facing lakes and facing rivers and streams in terms of monitoring what's going on with them and perhaps the interests of the people involved.
Sure. One of the big challenges on lakes that relates to rivers actually is we have many impoundments throughout the state where the rivers are feeding a lot of nutrient-rich water from industrial areas, urban areas, agricultural fields, bringing all that into one place, and the impoundments are a source of all that stuff collecting in one place. So that's a major challenge. We have some issues with algae blooms. Peatonwell and Castle Rock flowages are well known for large algae blooms. They have large watersheds that drain into these large reservoirs, and they're constantly battling algae blooms.
And those algae blooms make the lakes, make those impoundments virtually unusable sometimes during the hot months of the year.
Yeah, in some cases they can produce toxic algae, the blue-green algae we call them. They produce a neurotoxin in the water, so they can be harmful to people and dogs around the water. And
nobody wants to fish in it, you know?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't look very appealing. It can look pretty bad.
So we've got all of these challenges facing lakes and rivers and streams. How do you teach ordinary citizens to do the science that's necessary to monitor the water quality?
Sure. We provide all the equipment necessary for them to do it. The training is pretty basic, actually. We design the program so that the equipment is easy to use. It takes a minimal amount of training to use the equipment. And the complex things like the actual laboratory analysis to see how much phosphorus is in the water, for example, is actually done at the State Lab of Hygiene in Madison. So the volunteers are able to collect the water samples. They do some minimal processing of those samples, like filtration, and they actually send the samples down to the lab to do the more complex things.
So most of what they're using isn't really expensive stuff, right?
For the most part, it's fairly inexpensive stuff. Yep.
And are the techniques for monitoring rivers and streams different from monitoring lakes?
Many of the techniques are similar. They accomplish the same thing, but just have to use a slightly different piece of equipment. For example, with water clarity, we have what we call a Secchi disc. It's an 8-inch diameter black and white disc that you lower into the water, and you measure how far down the lake that you can still see that disc. In the case of a stream, you can't do that because the water's flowing. So you let out 8 feet of line, and you wouldn't be looking 8 feet vertical down in the water. It'd be getting swept downstream. So they actually capture a sample of that water in a large tube, and they have this tiny little mini Secchi disc that they lower into this tube of water to measure water transparency in there.
Got it. Now, this end of March weekend, it's also the Water Action Volunteers Annual Symposium and the 7th Citizen-Based Monitoring Conference.
Right.
And what's going on there?
So the Water Action Volunteers Network provides, they have a symposium every year where they, it's much like the Lakes Convention, they bring a lot of citizens together and local resource managers, and everybody talks about what's new developments, research, and what the citizens are seeing.
Is this also happening at the Holiday Inn?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so it's all happening together.
Yep.
Dan Belter, the same weekend, the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology is holding a community training event in Rothschild for volunteers who want to participate in the Breeding Bird Atlas. So let's start by having you tell us what the Breeding Bird Atlas is and what you're going to be doing in Rothschild that weekend.
Well, the Breeding Bird Atlas is a project to find out all the different species of birds that are breeding throughout the state of Wisconsin. And this is the second time this is being done in the state. The first time was 20 years ago. And the idea is to every 20 years do a Breeding Bird Atlas project and then compare the data of what species are expanding the ranges and what species are reducing their ranges in the state of Wisconsin.
And how do you teach the volunteers to gather this information?
There is a training session every year that the project is going on, and this year it's going to be down at the Stony Creek Inn in Rothschild. And the sessions, they teach people and what to look for in breeding behavior. It's not just actually finding a nest, but it's also, you know, other indications of, you know, looking for what birds do when they're, you know, to show if they're breeding or not.
Okay.
And
and I went online, and what I saw about the Breeding Bird Atlas is you had 700 observers surveying 2,600 atlas blocks and submitting 23,900 checklists documenting 1.7 million birds. That's a tall order for the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, we had 239 species that were confirmed breeding last year in the state of Wisconsin. That number should go up a little bit more as more blocks are being surveyed.
Why is this even necessary? Are breeding and migrating patterns changing in the state? Does climate change have something to do with that?
There is more species that are from the south moving northward to breed in Wisconsin, and the species that were at the southern end of their ranges are now going northward, and we're losing those.
I noticed, for instance, that at my bird feeder, I live just south of Merrill, we've got red-bellied woodpeckers, which never used to exist that far north, and they're there now.
Yeah, in the past 20, 25 years, they've expanded their range northward.
Interesting thing too for for hunters and for people who just enjoy wildlife is the proliferation of turkeys as a species in Wisconsin.
Yes,
and you've got a different range now for them from the first time you did this breeding bird atlas to the information that you're gathering now. Tell us about that.
In the first atlas project, they were pretty much in the southern counties of the state, and just over the past 20 years, they've just exploded in the central and northern counties too.
So we are talking today, dear listeners, to Eric Olson, Paul Skowinski, and Dan Belter about citizen science. If this topic interests you, if you're a citizen scientist, if you want to know how to get involved, if you think that we need more attention paid to science and our natural world, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it on the air. Eric, how did citizen science begin?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. It's a long history in one sense, because if you look far enough back, you'd find that there was no distinction between citizen science and non-citizen science. There was basically just science, and really anybody was considered fairly legitimate as a contributor to science. You could think about people like Ben Franklin, right? He's kind of well known as an inventor and a tinkerer and someone who was just out on a personal mission of discovery, and he contributed to our knowledge. Or even Charles Darwin was sort of one of these informal citizen scientists. But really, over the last 200 years in the modern era, we've tended to professionalize and set aside a different type of science, you know, formal science, where it's related to a very specific scientific research method. It's this Cartesian knowledge that we're building up, accruing sort of piles and piles of new data and new information year after year.
And generally performed by people who have doctorates or MS degrees or
they're
something.
They're in graduate school, they're going through this program, and then it takes place in our universities or in government laboratories, or it takes place in professionally funded laboratories. So we think of that as science, but what we miss out of that are a couple of things. One of them is that type of science can never afford to do the type of data collection that's needed to do ecological research. So when Dan's talking about these birds out there, the DNR, nobody could really hire all these people to do this as a professional research endeavor to scatter out across, you know, millions of square miles.
Yeah, 23,900 checklists. That's a lot of people.
Right. So instead, we almost think of this as crowdsourcing data, and that's a big part of what the Citizens Lake Monitoring Network people do, the Water Action Volunteers, and the people who are doing work with our bird populations. And so that's basically gives us a rich data source that covers a really large landscape to allow then – it usually gets fed into some more formal institutions that then crunch the numbers and do the data analysis to tell us something interesting, like about how the distribution of the turkeys might be changing over time.
So this interfaces with the experts at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. That's what you're telling me here.
Typically, yes. And they're interested in part because they have this obligation. It's a constitutional obligation, not just to take care of the water resources, but also all the wildlife in Wisconsin. The wildlife in Wisconsin is not owned by the DNR, and it's not owned by private citizens. It's owned by everybody collectively. It's a public good. And we hire the DNR to take care of it for us so that we don't have to wake up every day, all the people of Wisconsin, wondering what's happening with the bird populations. Instead, we've delegated that responsibility to the DNR. And then they've come back and asked us to help them out. They've said, look, we want to do this, but we don't have the manpower to do it all. And you could never pay the taxes necessary for us to hire that manpower. So we need people to volunteer and to step up and be at the table.
Paul, what have we learned about lakes and rivers as a result of all of this citizen-collected data?
Sure. Well, for one thing, the University of Wisconsin-Madison has recently done a big study mining a ton of this data, looking at over 250,000 observations on over 3,000 lakes, and looking at whether water quality was changing over time, or water clarity specifically changing over time as a whole. And what they found was, in general, on average, a lake is actually increasing slightly in its water clarity readings across the region. So there's certainly some lakes have gone down in water clarity, some lakes are going up. But
is that always a good thing? I mean, sometimes if you acidify the water too much, it will be clearer, but that's not necessarily good for the fish.
Sure, yeah. A common thing that comes up is the presence of zebra mussels, including increasing water clarity in lakes. And that's not a good thing, because the way that they increase water clarity is actually by removing plankton from the water and actually decreasing the food source for larval fish and other young creatures in the lake. So increased water clarity itself is not always good, but in this case, most of the time, these water clarity increases that our monitors are detecting are a result of decreasing phosphorus inputs into the lake, decreasing algae blooms, and other beneficial things to the lake.
And Dan Belder, if somebody wants to be a citizen scientist and volunteer to collect data for the Bird Breeding Atlas, you've got this this training session coming up at the end of the month at the Stony Creek Inn in Rothschild. What do they have to do to volunteer?
You can either attend a session, or you can just go to the website through the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. It's www.wsobirds.org. And there's information on there that you can access to the Breeding Bird Atlas website and learn about it from there, too.
We are talking about citizen science today on Route 51 with Eric Olson, director of UW Extension's Lakes Program, Paul Skowinski, Citizens Lake Monitoring Network educator at UW Extension, and Dan Belter, the Marathon County Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it. I'm Glenn Mulberg. When we come back, we'll hear about citizen science programs at the North Lakeland Discovery Center in Manitowish Waters and at the Boston School Forest in Plover. We're going to take a short break, but first, here's Firesign Theater's Porgy and Mudhead with a mystery at Moore Science High.
We need more schooling for more students for Moore Science High.
So you see, Mudhead, with counter-subversive educational priorities the way they are, well, it really helps our side to re-enlist.
Is that what you're going to do?
Oh, hell no. Right after I graduate, I'm going to cut the soles off my shoes, sit in a tree, and learn to play the flute.
Hey, look, Porgy!
Watch it!
Where are you going to graduate from?
Moore Science High! It's disappeared!
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wesley Heating and Cooling, TDS Custom Construction, and the Mead Witter Foundation. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium.
We're talking about citizen science today on Route 51 with Eric Olson, director of UW Extension's Lakes Program, Paul Skowinski, Citizens Lake Monitoring Network educator with UW Extension, and Dan Belter, Marathon County Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator. I'm Glenn Mulberg. You're listening to Tom Lehrer in a piece recorded in 1959. Yes, he is singing the entire periodic table of the elements.
Plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium.
And if you'd like to go to the Route 51 Facebook page, you'll find all of the websites we've been talking about listed there, the Bird Atlas, the Water Action Volunteers, and the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention.
These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
And again, that Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention takes place in Stevens Point, March 30th through April 2nd. You can register at uwsp.edu/uwex lakes. Over the past 6 weeks, the Stevens Point Area School District has been involved with training activities for the young scientists of tomorrow at its 80-acre Boston School Forest in Plover. They had 456 ninth-grade students from Ben Franklin Junior High and P.J. Jacobs Junior High participating in a citizen scientist monitoring program called Operation Feeder Watch. That training was made possible through a $10,000 grant from the Wisconsin Environmental Education Board. Here's Carla Lockman, the district's Boston School Forest Program leader, to tell us all about it.
Project Feeder Watch is one of the outdoor recreation things that everyone can do. It's asking you to write down what you see at your bird feeder and to record that data for ornithologists and people who study birds and bird populations to evaluate. So when the ninth graders come in, we give them a little lesson on how to identify the 10 most common Wisconsin birds that we are likely to see at our bird feeders. But it's really fun because, you know, when kids come in, they say, I don't know, what are we doing today? We're learning about birds. I don't want to know about birds. And it becomes the greatest thing when they come in from their 30 minutes of observation. We got to see a blue jay. We saw two cardinals. We saw 15 chickadees all at one time. Learning about birds all of a sudden becomes cool. And the hope is that if we can kickstart that love of nature and by using bird watching here at the Boston School Forest, that that's something that they can do when they graduate, when they're in college, when they're having their own family, when they're retired and grandparents. It's something that it can be done at any age level, and it's nice to be able to give them a little bit of that foundation.
How important is it for the development of young people and future adults and future citizens to give people an appreciation for the natural world and for science?
So I learned in my UWSP environmental education classes that there are two things that are the most important, the most vital, that have the biggest impact about people developing an appreciation for the natural world at a young age. And those two things are time spent in the outdoors and a positive role model. You know, this is a place that they visit for 12 times, once every single year at least, and then take those lessons home and say, what about my neighborhood matters? Do I recycle? Do I not recycle? Or do I smush this bug or do I let it live? You know, so even those kinds of questions, you know, you can see them forming opinions about things and really becoming more aware, more knowledgeable, and then saying, hey, this does matter to me.
And that is Carla Lockman, the Boston School Forest Program Leader for the Stevens Point Area School District, those ninth grade students getting involved with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Project Feeder Watch, thanks to that $10,000 grant from the Wisconsin Environmental Education Board. If you want to find out more about that, it's feederwatch.org. If you click on the link Explore, you'll see a variety of other links which allow you to see the changing numbers of various species of songbirds and raptors at bird feeders and other observation sites in Wisconsin and all across North America. And that changing number of birds that have been observed over the past 25 years is plotted on animated maps. So you can actually see just what climate change, for instance, is doing to different species. That data that was gathered by the kids at the Boston School Forest is going to become a part of the data on that site. Dan Belcher, your reaction to the experience that those kids are getting at the school forest, it's pretty wonderful, isn't it?
Very wonderful, yes. And they'll learn a lot throughout the rest of their lives what we're doing.
And it's so important to get people interested in science and get them interested in the natural world at an early age.
Yes, it is.
Is Operation Feeder Watch connected at all with the Breeding Bird Atlas, or are those two different things?
They're two different things, yes.
What do you think of Project Feeder Watch? This is, for one thing, a winter-long survey of birds that visit feeders between November and early April. Why generally do bird watchers do winter surveys? And, of course, this is a national thing, so you can see how they're moving from north to south and vice versa.
It shows what species are wintering where and you know, how their patterns are changing. You know, some species used to winter further north or, excuse me, further south. Now they're staying northward more. It's also showing patterns of eruptive species like the northern finches, if they're coming down out of Canada and how often they come down.
And how is climate change affecting our migrating birds?
It's doing a lot to them. They're shifting their migration patterns. They're no longer found in areas where they once used to be. And you know, they're breeding in different areas too of the country where they're no longer used to be breeding here. So
I talked to Marge Gibson, who directs the Raptor Education Group, a wildlife rehabilitation center in Antigo, and she said that because of climate change, hummingbirds have been migrating north, sometimes before the flowers bloom.
Yes.
So they get up here and there's nothing for them to eat.
That's about it too. And they can eat some small bugs, but they really they like the nectar that gives them a bigger boost of energy.
All right, we got the top 10 species of birds, according to your atlas in Wisconsin. Number one, of course, is the robin, which we are already seeing in March. The red-winged blackbird, the Canada goose, the black-capped chickadee, the European starling, the eastern bluebird, the common grackle. Surprises me that there's more observations of bluebirds than grackles. And what else do we have here? Number eight is the chipping sparrow, number nine the song sparrow, and number 10 the tree swallow.
Yes.
And then new species, the bufflehead.
Yep, they've been found nesting in several areas of the state now.
So. And and those are the white-headed ducks.
Yeah,
the
they're
diving
small.
Ducks.
Yep.
And you often see them, for instance, on the Wisconsin River amidst ice flows.
Yes, there's some on Lake Wausau right now. I checked this morning. So.
The Eurasian collared dove is new. The white-eyed vireo. The great tit, the Kirtland's warbler, which is really a pretty rare bird, isn't it?
Yeah, they're a federally endangered species.
And the yellow-throated warbler and the European goldfinch. People, you know, would say, well, we've got lots of goldfinches, but there's a difference, I guess.
Yeah, they were European goldfinches were released purposely by a bird trader somewhere down in the Chicago area, and they've actually kind of started expanding their range now. So it's actually not a good thing, but... But they are here. There's nothing we can do about it but except to monitor where they're going.
Eric Olson, how important are things like the at school forest in Plover to getting kids interested in all of this at an early age?
Yeah, I think people really will pattern their lifelong behavior based on some of their childhood experiences. And currently we're at a really interesting time when there's so many digital distractions that are pulling kids away from the outdoors, that are inspiring kids just to spend time on the computer or on their phones. And the outdoors is really suffering as a result. And I think a lot of people are afraid that if we lose a generation of people from engagement with the outdoors, then later on, they're not necessarily going to have the level of interest in protecting those outdoors or investing in taking care of our natural resources. So it's pretty important, I think, that people establish some connections early on.
And we need to realize, of course, that we're dependent on that natural world, whether we think it's important or not.
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin has a great tradition of people like Gaylord Nelson and Aldo Leopold, John Muir, pointing out sort of our ties to the natural world. We can't think of ourselves as being independent or somehow floating above nature. Instead, we're fully embedded within it. And Gaylord Nelson is famous for pointing out that our economy, where we get our jobs and our incomes, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the natural world.
Paul Skowinski, with the citizens that you deal with who are monitoring the quality of our lakes and rivers and streams, how many of them got interested in science and the natural world at an early age?
We hear it quite often that people that are monitoring their lakes grew up on that lake and they really care for the lake. They've loved it all their lives. They want to give back to the lake now and take care of it. It's a very common theme with our citizens.
And we have something right now called the Wisconsin Healthy Lakes Implementation Plan. Anyone want to jump in and talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a new project that's in its second year with the Department of Natural Resources leading the way, but fully a partnership endeavor to try to find some practices that really any shoreline property owner both can and should be taking to help protect the health of their lakes. So what we've identified is over a period of years, working with lake groups, identifying what the simple steps are. And they're not quite as simple as like changing a light bulb, but they are things that a property owner really should be thinking about, really in terms of like, where does your stormwater runoff go? This is a great time of year to be thinking about that. As you look out on the landscape, there's water everywhere. Well, some of that water, you know, historically used to just infiltrate into the ground and into the groundwater, and then it might pop up back in the lake as spring water, and in that process it'd be tremendously filtered and it wouldn't add to the nutrients and sediment that feed the algae blooms that we're concerned about. So how can we restore that? We can do that through things like rain gardens. We can put in infiltration trenches. We can find ways to let the water soak back into the ground. That's an important part of the solution. And the DNR is basically trying to find a way to make it easier for property owners to both do those practices and even get state funding to help them do it to offset the cost.
Those are diversion practices, right?
Correct.
And I was looking at that plan, and they divide a typical lake into three management zones. You got the lake itself.
Yep.
Then you got a transition period, which is basically the shoreline.
Yep.
And then you've got upland, which is a little bit further back.
Yep. So the upland area is where you're doing these stormwater practices typically. And then as you get right on the lake's edge, another thing we've kind of done, whether we were conscious of it or not, we heavily modified the shoreline landscape. We take out most of the native plants and shrubs and trees. And over time, we gradually put in Kentucky bluegrass and rocks. And that's not a healthy habitat. That's not something that the plants and animals around a lake are going to get much out of. So what we're trying to do is encourage property owners to maybe bite off maybe like 350 square feet, 35 feet by 10 feet. Can you put in some native plants there, some shrubs, some trees that are going to provide that ecological niche that especially songbirds and other birds depend upon, as well as the insects that those birds are going to come along and try to feed off of? So again, that's that transition area where we're trying to get native plants in. And then right in the lake is really one of the more exciting spots where, again, humans have gone around and in the spirit of cleaning things up, we've taken out a lot of trees that have fallen into lakes over hundreds of years. And those trees are critical habitat, not just for fish, for turtles, for frogs, and also, again, for all the insects that are the basis of much of the food web out there. If you take those trees out, you lose a big part of the food web. We're now working with the DNR to get many of these trees put back into lakes.
So by cleaning up your lake, you're actually hurting your fishing recreational opportunities in that lake. And by taking out the native plants and putting Kentucky bluegrass in, Paul, that adds to phosphorus runoff, which can destroy the water quality.
Right, exactly. Those three zones are really interconnected, and people don't often associate all three of them together, but water quality in that lake itself is greatly impacted by the transition zone and the upland area. So some of our citizens will do water chemistry testing, and they'll find that the numbers are a little higher than they'd like. They have more phosphorus, more chlorophyll than they would like to see. Those, of course, are numbers that influence algae populations in the lake. So one of the things they can do to decrease that that loading of phosphorus and chlorophyll into the lake is actually do things on the upland areas, create a rain garden, some kind of diversion process or project that would divert that water away from the lake, let it infiltrate into the groundwater, be filtered before it actually gets to the water. It's very beneficial, and often you can plant them in wildflowers and shrubs that are very aesthetically pleasing, and most people are extremely pleased with the wildlife that they attract when they create one of these projects.
And then you've got beautifully manicured lawns, Dan, and people put bird feeders up, but they've taken away the habitat that those birds would depend on.
Right. The habitat is the key. You need that for the birds, and if you have that, they're going to come.
We're talking about citizen science today on Route 51 with Eric Olson, the director of UW Extension's Lakes Program, Paul Skowinski, Citizen Lake Monitoring Network Educator with UW Extension, and Dan Belter, the Marathon County Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator. If you would like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742, or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg. When we come back, we'll hear about an upcoming citizen science program at the North Lakeland Discovery Center in Manitouish Waters. But first, here's Bare Naked Ladies with the musical observation, Australopithecus would probably be sick of us.
Australopithecus would really have been sick of us debating how we're here, they're catching deer.
We're catching viruses.
Religion or astronomy, God or Deuteronomy, it all started with the Big Bang.
Music and mythology,
Einstein and astrology, it all started with the Big Bang.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Minnesota Marine Art Museum, College of St. Scholastica, and Paisan's Portabella. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Marshfield Clinic. In 1916, six physicians formed a group practice and named it after the community. 100 years later, Marshfield Clinic is proud to be serving the healthcare needs of Wisconsin for generations. MarshfieldClinic.org.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo-ho, it's hot. The sun is not a place where we could live, but here on Earth there'd be no life without the light it gives. We need its light.
They Might Be Giants, taking us into our final segment on Route 51 as we continue our conversation about citizen science with Eric Olson, director of UW Extension's Lakes Program, Paul Skowinski, the Citizen Lake Monitoring Network educator with UW Extension, and Dan Belter, the Marathon County Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator. The Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention takes place in Stevens Point, March 30th through April 2nd, and you can register at uwsp.edu/uwexlakes. Eric Olson, we got a John on Facebook, and I'm going to see if you can answer this for us. Recently, last year, Senate Bill 459 was signed into law in the state of Wisconsin. What are your thoughts about how this will affect the health of lakes and rivers in our state?
Sure. And I think my understanding of Senate Bill 459 is that it is still waiting governor's signature. This was it came out as Assembly Bill 600 to begin with. And 459 is just the Senate naming for it. It has the original version, AB 600, I think had a lot of things in it that were really favoring the interests of shoreland property owners and private property rights over the health and well-being of the lakes. The Senate version was dramatically modified to take out a lot of these things that were sort of the most challenging things that would have faced lakes. And that was largely due to Senator Rob Coles, who's been part of, I think, the Lakes Partnership for a long time. And he recognized that some of these things were a little bit much. And so it was toned down significantly and then kicked back to the Assembly and passed there. So I think my understanding is that it's still awaiting governor's signature. This is really part of this ongoing challenge of balancing, I think, the broad public interest in lakes and the broad public ownership of lakes that I talked about before. They're owned by everybody, and we just hired the DNR to take care of them for us, as well as these private property rights for the people who are riparian property owners. What we really hope to do, I think, is just inspire in people a much better understanding of how lakes work and why certain things are going to be harmful to the lake and why shoreland property owners have actually a very unique obligation or responsibility to be part of the solution for taking care of those lakes.
And maybe if you do that, whatever laws are passed won't matter because people will already be doing the right thing.
Right. And really that Healthy Lakes Initiative is one good example of this, where we're trying to identify who are the people out there. We know there's hundreds, if not thousands of them out there who can be part of the solution.
The North Lakeland Discovery Center in Manitouish Waters has been involved with citizen science efforts for many years, and they've got one coming up on April 16th, a National Citizen Science Day hike. Here's the organization's research and monitoring coordinator, Heather Lumpkin, to tell us more.
2016 will mark the first National Citizen Science Day announced by the Citizen Science Association. And in celebration of this day, we're going to be holding a free guided hike that will take place here on the Discovery Center trails. And during this program, you'll get to learn about how to be involved in local and statewide and national citizen science projects, doing things like surveying birds and bats, watching for aquatic invasive species, monitoring phenology, and things like that.
You do quite a bit of scientific training of volunteers and just regular people at the North Lakeland Discovery Center. Tell me some of the things that you do and why you think that's important.
Well, citizen science is, in fact, the act of engaging the members of the public in a different processes of science. And we really like to get people involved at a variety of different levels so that they can gain a greater appreciation for the natural world around them and also for science in general. For example, we do a bird banding program where we engage people in using bird banding as a tool. We support the annual Midwest crane count by coordinating Vilas County. We also do bat surveys. This is coordinated at a state level, and we support these efforts by training local volunteers, sending them out with an acoustic bat monitoring device.
Why is it important to give people more of an understanding of the natural world and an appreciation of it?
I believe that giving people a greater appreciation and understanding of the natural world through science helps them form those connections that are going to hopefully translate into actions later on. Gaining skills in science at the same time as gaining knowledge can often translate more easily into changes in actions and attitudes in people.
That's Heather Lumpkin. She's a research and monitoring coordinator with the North Lakeland Discovery Center in Manitouish Waters. That National Citizen Science Day hike takes place April 16th, and you can find out more at discoverycenter.net. And Heather gives us an example of bird banding volunteers who come in contact with birds that have been injured by banging into windows. And often those volunteers will then go home and put stickers on their windows or blinds to keep more birds from getting injured. And Dan, she says that's an example of how science and understanding of it can change attitudes about the natural world.
Yes.
And she's also involved with the annual crane count. How important is that crane count and what the Discovery Center is doing in tracking the numbers up in Vilas County?
Well, the crane count started many years ago, and back when sandhill cranes were pretty rare in Wisconsin, and over time that has tracked their population increases and also their range expansion too throughout the state.
And Paul Skowinski, the North Lakeland Discovery Center, it's in the middle of lake country up north. How important are they to the Citizen Lake Monitoring Network?
Very important. The area that they're based in has very few aquatic invasive species in the lakes, and that's one of the things that they monitor up there. It's important to be proactive about those. Instead of reacting to large populations that have been established in lakes, it's great to have people out there monitoring these lakes to catch early populations, which are much less expensive and much more effective to manage.
And you've got aquatic invasive plant species, but you've also got invasive animal species like the rusty crayfish,
right,
which has decimated fish habitat in lakes like Star Lake up in Vilas County. They now, you know, it's hard to catch walleyes in that lake now, but they have a crayfish festival instead. So
The rusty crayfish are very good at removing aquatic vegetation from lakes. They go along and basically just clip the vegetation. Sometimes they'll eat it, sometimes they won't. But there are certain fish species that actually broadcast their eggs directly on vegetation. So if the vegetation isn't there, then those fish are going to suffer. And other species that actually deposit their eggs into gravel or rock bars will suffer because these crayfish are actually hiding between these rocks, and they'll feed on the eggs as they're deposited within the bars.
Eric Olson, the lakes up north, they're the crown jewels of our Wisconsin environment. And as we've been saying, it's up to citizens to monitor them for invasive species and also other threats.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, when you engage in citizen science, when you go out and do measurements, whether it's going out and observing birds or going out and observing loons on your lake or doing the water quality measurements, we believe that you actually develop a much more intimate relationship with that resource, and you start to become a very strong advocate for taking care of those resources. One of our presenters at the convention is a woman named Chris Stepanek, and she's actually part of this broad national effort to promote citizen science. She used to work for UW Extension. She coordinated the WAVE program for a long time, and her research is actually about how this experience of getting engaged in volunteering and citizen science changes people, and it's pretty remarkable. We're going to hear from her firsthand, sort of that story, on Thursday at the convention. It's really exciting to have her coming back to Wisconsin now and sharing this information.
And Dan Belder, again, that same weekend, you've got that training session for volunteers at the Stony Creek Inn, people who might want to monitor the changing patterns of bird migration and breeding in Wisconsin. What do they have to do if they want to get involved in that?
Attend the seminar and go to the website, sign up for it to be an atlaser, and then go from there. Pick out a block, and I'll okay it and start surveying.
And again, what's the website?
It's, you go to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website at wsobirds.org.
And that'll give you a link
to the Breeding Bird Atlas.
All right. Thanks to all of you for being with us today. The hour has gone very quickly.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science.
We want to thank today's guests, Eric Olson, Director of UW Extension's Lakes Program, Paul Skowinski, Citizen Lake Monitoring Network Educator with UW Extension, and Dan Belter, the Marathon County Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator. Thanks also to Carla Lockman, Boston School Forest Program Leader with the Stevens Point Area School District, and Heather Lumpkin of the North Lakeland Discovery Center. A reminder, the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention takes place in Stevens Point March 30th through April 2nd. You can register at uwsp.edu/UWEXLakes. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music and audio segments today by Mose Allison, Paul McCartney, Firesign Theater, Tom Lehrer, Bare Naked Ladies, They Might Be Giants, and Thomas Dolby. Next Thursday on Route 51, we talk to survivors of Japanese internment camps operated by the U.S. government in Arizona during World War II, thanks to the Walk in Their Shoes School History Program. Because of the Supreme Court justice debate on Friday, this program will not be rebroadcast as it normally is. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.